Okay, welcome everyone. So it's great pleasure to have Juicy Lu as today's condensed matter seminar. So Juicy did her PhD with Professor Yongxi Wu at Utah in 2019. And since then, she has been a postdoc at KITP at Santa Barbara. And today Juicy will tell us about a Moyer system beyond, I guess, graphene in more general setting. Okay, please go ahead, Juicy.
Thanks for the introduction. Hello, everyone. So the plan of this talk is to introduce a couple of related topics on the heterostructures of two-dimensional Van der Waals materials with a focus on the twisted bilayer systems. I will start with a brief introduction on the Van der Waals heterostructures. These materials consist of atomically thin two-dimensional single layer of crystals. Strong covalent bonds provide in-plane stability of these 2D crystals, whereas relatively weak Van der Waals-like forces, they keep the stack together. They can, for example, be exfoliated from the bulk materials. Two-dimensional materials are well known for their enhanced quantum fluctuations and strong correlations. And interestingly, for these materials, unlike many other strongly correlated materials, they can be rather precisely controlled in experiments. You can add various external perturbations as well, like gating, lights, pressure, strengths, proximity effects, etc. So there are a lot of things that can be tuned. In particular, people can stack different materials on top of each other with high precision and construct designer heterostructures like an atomic Lego. The most interesting feature that will enter is the Moray pattern. Now, please allow me to use an example from classical acoustics to help intuitively explain what Moray means. For the experts in the room, you may want to grab a snack, check your mailbox, and come back in a few minutes. So consider two sine waves of similar frequency and combine them. The resultant wave is effectively a frequency F1 minus F2. Ignoring the high frequency oscillations in this envelope. The closer the frequencies F1 and F2, the smaller the resultant beat frequency will be. Now let's go to the Moray of this two-dimensional Van der Waals materials. Consider two layers of honeycomb lattices with a slightly different lattice constants and stacked together. One observes that there can be a triangular superlattice structure of this bilayer system, which we call a Moray pattern. This superlattice exhibits a much larger scale than the original lattice, which means the Moray physics is more relevant at lower energy scales. This has a similar flavor as the case of the beats. So recall in the case of beats, the smaller the frequency difference between the two waves, the smaller the final effective frequency will be. Here, the smaller the difference between the lattice constants between the two layers, the smaller the Moray brilliant zone will be. Or in a real space, the larger the superlattice will be. Okay, the Moray pattern doesn't necessarily need to arise from different lattice constants. One can also consider two otherwise identical layers of honeycomb lattices and are twisted by a relative angle. This picture is for twisted angles of 65 degrees. We again see a triangular superlattice structure. And here is another case for twisting angle of 36 degrees. So in the twisted case, the lattice constant of the superlattice increases as we decrease the twisting angle. One thing to remark is that we don't always have a periodic superlattice structure. Under a rotation of angle theta, the position r in general goes to r plus this, with z being a unit vector pointing out of the screen. At the rotation center, everything is aligned. Then at some position r, if everything gets aligned again, we will have some periodicity. So a periodicity requires this theta z hat r to be some lattice vector A, with A being certain combinations of the basis vectors on the parent honeycomb lattice. Solving this equation for R, we get R equals this thing. In other words, we can have a superlattice structure if R is equal to this expression, which is the Moray lattice vector. However, strictly, this R should also be written as a certain combination of the original lattice basis vectors. For small enough theta, this term is so big such that there is always a original lattice vector that is close to this. That's why effectively we have periodicity. But this is clearly not satisfied for generic theta. So for generic theta, this is only a quasi-periodic system. It will be quite a pain to study systems without translational symmetry, but one can go to the continuum. So in the first parts of my talk, I'll explain a continuum of description of the Moray systems at hand, where the periodicity can be restored, block theorem can be applied, and better still, the formalism will work for any elastic deformations. Okay, before diving into that, let me show you some more of the status of the field. In the past several years, this field of Moray heterostructures has attracted a huge amount of attention, and it has become a field called twistotronics. This twisted bilayer mania started with the twisted bilayer graphene, which was shown to exhibit exotic strongly correlated behaviors at a series of magic twisting angles, such as 1.1 degrees. They have mod insulating behaviors, as well as unconventional superconductivity, et cetera. And soon after twisted bilayer graphene, both experimentalists and theorists begin exploring the numerous possibilities and stacking everything on everything. For example, the bilayer transition metal dichrocogenide, graphene stacked on something else, trilayer graphene, spin liquid candidate stacked with graphene, stack of surface states in 3D topological insulators, stacking materials on different lattices, growing heterostructures on weird non-Euclidean surfaces, twisting monolayer superconductors, et cetera. So it has become a real business, which you can see from the citation number. Okay, so Vandewalt's heterostructures comprise a new playground for us to work on. And roughly, the works can be classified into several directions. Number one is a simulator. The Moray manipulations use quantum interference to quench the energy scales in the system, often permitting a strong coupling, interaction-dominated regime, and also with enhanced anisotropies. In addition, they are tunable. So these systems are feasible to realize and control a large number of fundamental many-body quantum models that are relevant in condensed matter systems. And also, as a generator of new physics, because of this richness, there can be a lot of new physics intrinsic to the Moray systems that are not present in other systems. And as material realizations of known exotic physics that hasn't been realized yet. For example, one can think of designing a system such that the various geometric or interaction related frustrations are enhanced and the spin liquid behavior is favored as a ground state. And finally, there are a lot of device applications as well. In this talk, I will mostly focus on generating the new physics part. Okay, so here's the outline of my talk. I have briefly introduced the status of the field. The first topic in my talk is the Moray heterostructures of magnetically ordered systems. These works are done in collaboration with Khosra Hijazi and Leon Balint, both from UC Santa Barbara. Most of the works mentioned before focused on electronic properties of Moray systems. But there are also 2D magnetism, which hosts very interesting physics. We will be interested in the Vandewalt's magnets, which has intrinsic magnetic moments that are basically magnetic versions of graphene. One of the theoretical motivations to study such materials is that they have been found to realize all the fundamental spin Hamiltonians, such as Heisenberg model, Ising model, and XY models. Therefore, these materials provide a platform to thoroughly examine various well-established theories. And there are really a lot of them. These two of the materials contain ferromagnets, antiferromagnets, insulators, semiconductors, metals, etc. And again, they allow for the control and the manipulation of magnetic states through coupling to various external perturbations. So one can imagine a lot of questions to be asked and answered, which I will discuss shortly. Okay, this picture again. To gain some intuition, let's start by considering a single layer of honeycomb lattice with antiferromagnetic nearest neighbor Heisenberg interaction. Since honeycomb is a bipartite lattice, it's easy to see that the system will have a nail order. The spins in one sublattice point in one direction, while the spins in another sublattice point in some other direction, the opposite direction. The order parameter is then the nail vector n, the staggered spin. Okay. Now, if we take another layer and twist it by the angle, one observe that so for this superlattice structure in the bilayer system, and suppose there is an antiferromagnetic interlayer interaction that is also of Heisenberg form, then near this region of AA type of stacking, where the red sublattice is on top of the red sublattice and blue is on top of blue, then because of this antiferromagnetic interlayer interaction, the null vectors from the two layers will point in opposite directions. And near the other type of regions, the AB stacked region where the red sublattice is on top of the blue, while the blue is on top of red, the null vectors from the two layers point in the same direction. One can also try ferromagnetic interlayer interactions. They'll have qualitatively similar behaviors. And the main message is, since different regions of the system favor different types of configurations, we have generated frustration all of it. Basically, the null vectors must rotate and a non-collinear ordering is generated. As mentioned before, we will formulate this problem using a continuum theory, which simplifies the problem by restoring periodicity in a generally only quasi-periodic systems. It also helps to relieve the pressure to study a huge number of size and spins with complicated local environments due to stacking. We know that when two layers are trivially stacked, one only needs to study an interaction between one side in one layer and some neighboring sides in another layer. However, when there's a twisting, everything gets messed up and an interlayer term would be very complicated to write down all lattice. So a continuum model would be simple. Also, it reduces the two basic dimensionless parameters of the problem, the ratio of the interlayer to intralayer hopping and the twisting angle or lattice mismatch. They combine these two parameters into a single one, which we will see later. Our formalism works directly in real space for general elastic deformation U under the following assumptions. One, the deformations are slowly varying such that the elasticity theory applies, but the displacement fields themselves don't need to be small. And also we will assume that the interlayer exchange is small compared to the intralayer exchange. These are widely applicable and achievable in the Van der Waals systems. Under these assumptions, the interlayer coupling and the displacements have significant effects only at low energies or long range. I should mention that this continuum treatment was inspired by the Tuzobayer graphene studies. We will use Eulerian coordinates where the coordinate in an undeformed ideal lattice is capital R, and the actual location of the spin in a deformed lattice is X. The deformation U is a function of X instead of a function of R, which means that we use this Eulerian coordinates, which makes the locality manifest. So when we consider two layers with different large deformations, for example, for twisting and for sides away from the rotation center, a single value of capital R in the two layers correspond to two very different physical locations. So like locality is not really manifest there. The Eulerian coordinates, or global coordinates, if you like, it restores this locality. And in analogy with fluid dynamics, U of R fix a particle and tracks its motion, while U of X fix a position and tracks the flux. Okay, we again use the example of bilayer nail orderings on honeycomb lattice to illustrate the formalism. For each layer, we have the endoferromagnetic Heisenberg model, which translates into this nonlinear sigma model with L being the layer index. We will also add the single ion anisotropy. So there is a material manganese thiophosphate for this model. Next, we consider the geometric effect of displacement. Carrying out the coordinate transformation from capital R to X in a single layer and finding the strain induced to changes in the energetic, we get this L1 for each layer. Here, delta are some constants, and epsilon is the strain field expressible by the deformation U. But in the layer of my talk, we will mostly be interested in rigid twists. So this term can actually be disregarded. I just show it here to show that we can have a general description. All right. Then we add the interlayer exchange. So assuming locality and translational symmetry, it has the following form. Locality means that we have only N1 of X dot N2 of X. And it depends only on this F depends only on U1 minus U2, because translating the two layers by the same vector would not affect the interlayer physics. And here F can be expanded in Fourier series and approximated by a small number of harmonics based on the single layer translational symmetry. The total Lagrangian is then the sum of all these. We will fix the form of F in the next page. The spin density for the undeformed parent lattice can be written as a following minimal for expansion. N0 is some constant, B0 are the reciprocal lattice vectors. And one can check that this form satisfies all the symmetry constraints. And since we're interested in the deformed lattice, we write R in terms of X minus U. And with this parameterization, the interlayer coupling term becomes this after some manipulation. The sum of cosines, where we have already defined U1 minus U2 being just a single U. And next, we specify the case of a rigid twist, giving this phi of x defined as the summation of cosines again, where this qi's will be the Moray reciprocal lattice vectors, defined in this way. And for convenience, we switch to some dimensionless parameterization such that the Moray scale is of order one. And we first, so let's analyze the classical Hamiltonians of the following form. Now we try to look at the ground state configurations of this Hamiltonian. Let's ignore beta firstly and consider the isotropic case. In the strong coupling region of this large alpha or small twisting angle, one observes that the nail vectors in the two layers tend to be parallel or anti-parallel depending on the sine of phi of x. So here is a plot of the sine of phi of x, which has periodicity of the Moray scale and it's positive in the blue region. This minus sign should be in the yellow region. So it's positive in the blue region, negative in the yellow region, with circular domain walls at the places where phi of x is zero. When alpha is small, the kinetic term dominates and n wants to be uniform throughout the space. Some first order perturbation shows that this order parameters in the two layers tend to be perpendicular to each other throughout the whole region. This is rather intuitive as a relative angle of 90 degrees makes it easy for the order parameter in the two layers to become parallel or anti-parallel in the regions of different sides of phi of x. For general values of alpha, the n vectors in the two layers will be coplanar and smoothly interpolate between these two limits. Assume the classical saddle lies in the XZ plane, then the Hamiltonian reduces to that of just the Sine-Gordon model with the spatially dependent coupling phi of x. The Magnus spectrum can be computed above the saddle point solution, which exhibits three Goldstone modes. So one of them corresponds to the rotation of phi 1 plus phi 2 in the plane, and the other two correspond to rotations of phi's in the two layers out of the plane. And interestingly, the Magnus bands flatten at large alpha. So this is simply due to the fact that the Moray potential term becomes alternated deep wells or hard walls confining the magnons to either of the two domains.
Sorry, could you explain again why for small r but they want to be perpendicular?
Yeah, so yes. So at a strong coupling limit, for different signs of phi of x, this two vectors want to be either parallel or anti-parallel. For small alpha, they want to be perpendicular, which intuitively makes it easier for this n1 dot n2 to be parallel or anti-parallel in different regions. So this is only a first order perturbation result. On second order, it will be no longer uniform and has this more like Moray modulation.
So when you say perpendicular, N1 and N2 wants to be perpendicular to each other?
Yes, power two.
So the system doesn't gain energy from the last time coupling?
Yes, at this order, yes.
Mm-hmm. So but how do you know that there's, I'm not sure whether there's still a better energetically better configuration even for small alpha?
So for small alpha, this uniform N1 dot N2 being zero is like the uniform solution as if there's no alpha. But this solution arises from the first order equations of motion in a perturbation.
Mm. Okay.
And next, we add back the beta term of anisotropy, which is present in the Van der Waals materials. When beta is larger than zero, the easy anisotropy, this term prefers collinear configuration along positive or negative z. And this competes with the interlayer Moray potential term, which prefers the twisted configurations at positive and negative regions of phi of x. And using perturbation theories, strong coupling, dimensional analysis, and numerics, we can find that these two that there are two such twisted faces called twisted S and twisted A, occupying different regions of this phase diagram. In the twisted A phase, the purple and black arrows show the nail vectors in the two layers. The n vector in one layer remains the same, while the n vector in the other layer switches by 180 degrees across the domain walls. And while in the twisted S phase, both layers are in plane in the blue region and out of plane in the orange region. These two phases can be better understood in a system in a symmetric and anti-symmetric basis. Denote phi of S is phi 1 plus phi 2, and phi of A equals phi 1 minus phi 2. At large alpha, the Moray potential term wants the cosine phi of A to be plus or minus 1 in the blue or orange regions. And this term only cares about phi of A instead of phi of S. When beta is large, one wants cosine phi of S to follow the sign change of cosine phi of A. This leads to the twisted A phase. So phi S is always equal to phi of A. In comparison, if beta is small, this kinetic term wins the competition and phi of S wants to stay constant in the whole space. Since phi of X is negative or orange in most of the space, cosine phi of A is negative in most of the space. So cosine phi of S wants to stay the most negative value. Phi S should be pi. This gives the twisted S phase. Also, in both weak and strong coupling limits, the transition line between the collinear and twisted phases is beta goes to alpha squared. One can further study various models using this formalism. For example, one can generalize to the case of zigzag antiferromagnets, which happen to be the cases for materials iron thiophosphate, cobalt thiophosphate, and nickel thiophosphate. The zigzag order being a collinear magnetic order, which doubles the unit cell, remarkably at strong coupling, the result is a tiling of six possible zigzag patterns, which evokes like a dice lattice. The three come from three possible spatial orientations of the zigzag chains of the line sphinx, and the two come from the parallel and anti-parallel of the order parameters in the two layers. One can also look at homo bilayers of ferromagnets. In particular, this weird material, chromium trialdide, has an interlayer exchange with a strength and sign depending upon its displacement between the neighboring layers. This can be directly incorporated into a continuum model. And it's basically the same Hamiltonian as before, but with a different phi of x. And also, of course, the nail vector n will be substituted by the magnetism vector m. And again, the Moray potential can lead to a twisted phase where there are large regions with some net magnetization, while the other regions have vanishingly small net magnetization. And the twisted bilayer of chromium trialdide has been validated by experiments from Cornell's group. When there is no twisting, there's some spin flip transition for the antiferromagnet B around 0.6. And at large twisting, which corresponds to the weak coupling limit, there is only some ferromagnetic loop behavior centered at B equals zero. While at small twisting or strong coupling limit or large alpha, there's a mixture of ferromagnetic and antiferromagnetic behavior. And they also observe the transition between the twisted phase and collinear phase as expected, which is nice. Okay, cool. So one further next,
can I ask some questions?
Yes.
Can you go to the slide where you showed the formalism? And let's make sure I understand the logic here. So are you assuming the single layer is already in the ordered state?
Yes.
Here, this NL in principle varies at the scale of single layer lattice spacing?
Yes.
I'm asking because here you are talking about honeycomb lattice, which is a lattice free of LSM anomaly. And you are describing this, you are using a nonlinear sigma model that is also anomaly free to describe it.
Uh-huh.
But if you are on a triangular lattice neural hub system, in principle,
then this nonlinear single model doesn't apply there because the anomaly is too much. Also, for any ferromagnet, in order to have the quadratic dispersion of the micron, I guess you need to add to the nonlinear single model somewhere similar with winter. That can in principle also affect some of the analysis. Can you comment on this?
I agree, yes. So let me first say something about the triangular lattice. So triangular lattice, the magnetic ordering is, instead of collinear, it's coplanar for a single layer. And there will be two flavors of nail vectors instead of just one. So we can write down that single layer Lagrangian as well. Similarly, one can use symmetry to constrain the form of this interlayer term, but it will again involve like four types of terms, like N1A dot N2A, N1A dot N2B, etc. So, and then in general, we kind of looked a little bit into this system, and at strong coupling, it actually gives something very interesting. It gives some Moray magnetic vortices of Moray triangular lattice of vortices, which is usually what you would expect, that the vortices will be like in a KD transition favored by entropy. But in this case, in a triangular lattice case of Moray magnets, these vortices are favored by energy.
So, by strong coupling, do you mean strong coupling in terms of the nonlinear scale model coupling constant?
Strong coupling, I mean the big alpha or small twisting angle.
Uh-huh. But you always assume the single layer is deep in the ordered phase.
Yes, I always assume that, yes.
Uh-huh.
I don't have a deep understanding of the additional Vesuvino-Witten term and what its effect will be, but it will be an interesting thing to consider.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
One further question to answer is that, can we get topologically non-trivial magnetic textures on top of just being non-collinear? I guess Liu Jun's question is also related to that. One interesting magnetic texture is skirmions. Skirmion lattices have also very recently been observed in Van der Waals magnets. And a region of such phase are all attributed to Diallo-Sinsky-Moreau interactions. We will use two different materials as a two layers without any twisting to study Moreau skirmions. But the formalism will also apply to the twisting case. So this is a single layer Hamiltonian with DM interaction in the ferromagnetic layer and some anisotropy in the interferromagnetic layer. This is due to consideration of materials. The interlayer term can be derived in a similar fashion as the homo bilayer case. When the lattice mismatch is small, the Heisenberg interaction is then of the following form. Here D is the difference in the reciprocal lattice vectors of the two layers, which will be the Moray reciprocal lattice vector. And next, we assume the spin stiffness in the antiferromagnetic layer is large enough such that it's static, and the nail vectors will point along the z direction due to anisotropy. In the dimensionless coordinates where the Moray scale is of order one, we arrive at the following effective Hamiltonian for the ferromagnetic layer. Here is a plot of this phi of x, and again has this triangular structure. Now, let's analyze the Hamiltonian in some easy limits. When alpha and beta are both zero, the magnetization is simply uniform. And when there are no Moray potential, the DM interaction favors spirals of 2 pi over beta. And since we have a two-dimensional sample, it's a spiral in one direction and uniform in the other direction. When beta is zero and we only have a Moray potential, it's similar to the previous homo bilayer case. The MZ wants to point up or down based on the sine of phi of x. To make it easier for the eyes, I will delete the spins pointing down or into the screen. Now it's clear that we have this triangular lattice structure. The configuration will be coplanar. And at the positions where phi of x is equal to zero, this M vectors want to be in plane, but the specific direction is not fixed. In other words, there is some SO2 symmetry. And once we turn on a not so large beta, it will break this SO2 symmetry and fix the orientation of the M vectors on these domain walls. To see this, we rewrite the DM term using the following ways. The first term can be understood as the following. The M prefers to be perpendicular to the gradient of MZ, which lies normal to the domain walls. And the second rewriting says that there is a circulation around each domain. So the 1D domain walls wants to have the following type of configurations. However, the configurations near the vertices are not fixed. They're actually frustrated as it cannot follow the configurations of all the 1D domain walls at the same time. Okay, there are several possible elementary vertex configurations. One is this vertex the vertex follows one of the 1D domain walls. There are three directions, so we call this three-state clock vertex configuration. The other is that it points out of the plane following either domain. We call this an easing type of vertex. Both types of vertices show up as different commensurate phases in a numerical phase diagram we found using micromagnetic minimization. So there is a two-state phase with the three-state clock vertex, which has the usual translation symmetry and a reflection symmetry with respect to the horizontal y equals zero line. And we also find a Skirmian lattice phase with the easing vertex and all the vertices are pointing down or into the screen. There's one Skirmian per Moray unit cell. This phase does not have a reflection, but holds the C3 rotation symmetry. There's also what we call easing stripy phase with the easing vertices alternatively pointing up and down in a vertical direction. So the easing stripy phase breaks translational symmetry in a y direction and don't have reflection or C3 rotation symmetries. Since these three phases differ only in the Moray vertices, it's really hard to distinguish analytically which one gives the ground state, especially these commensurate phases are relevant at very large alphas. Numerically, but we can see that when alpha is large, these three phases all have their territories, especially when alpha is large enough, or when the lattice mismatch is small enough, one expects the Moray Skirmian stripy easing phases to always dominate. We have seen that when alpha is subdominant compared to beta, there's a spiral phase. Since the spiral can have a period that is different from that of the Moray lattice, we call this the incommensurate phase. Let me comment on the commensurate-incommensurate transition from a weak coupling perspective. We use the following parameterization in polar coordinates. One can then derive the equations of motion from the Hamiltonian. To zeroth order in beta, it's the same as homobilayer case. The Euler-Lagrange equation simplifies to this. And the perturbation again shows the solution has a definite mean value for theta, which is pi over 2 in each Moray unit cell.
Now it slowly comes back to me. I don't remember. So indeed, the first order energetics does not So this pi over 2 does not give a lower energy at first order perturbation, but the second order perturbation will break this degeneracy and favor this average theta to be pi over 2. To study the commensurate-incommensurate transition, we allow the mean value of theta to fluctuate slowly as the position varies. A different mean value of theta can be obtained by adding a Lagrange multiplier into the sequence of motion to be solved order by order. Fluctuation of the mean value, of course, results in an energy penalty due to the Moray potential, but this should be compensated by the DM or beta term. The competition between these two terms can be effectively described by this Hamiltonian. This Hamiltonian falls into the form of Frank van der Merwe model of commensurate-incommensurate transition back in the 40s. In particular, there is a soliton solution to the equation of motion of this Hamiltonian. This soliton describes this commensuration where bar theta jumps by pi. And this soliton is of width of inverse alpha. In general, the solutions are regularly spaced solitons or soliton lattice. In the literature, this is also called some double staircase. So bar theta has a staircase dependence of y. This soliton lattice is a compromise between the Unklapp term, the Moray potential, or which favors bar theta being pi over 2 plus n pi, and the elastic energy, or the DM term, which favors bar theta equals beta times y. The separations between solitons become larger and larger as one approaches from the incommensurate phase to the transition line, and it diverges at the transition line. Near the line where the soliton density is low, the energy density takes the following form. The first term describes the soliton energy, and the second term describes the repulsion between the solitons. So when alpha term is small enough or beta is large enough such that the soliton energy becomes negative, the commensurate phase will become unstable to the spontaneous formation of walls. This happens when the first term vanishes. So we conclude that the critical beta has a linear relationship with alpha, and the separation between solitons will diverge logarithmically at the transitional line.
Sorry, Juicy, can I slow you down a little bit just to make sure I remember what these symbols are? So alpha is the twisting angle, right?
Alpha is like J prime divided by the twisting angle.
Okay, and what decides beta?
Beta is the DM interaction.
Oh, I see. Okay, I see. All right, thanks.
No problem. Okay, and this theoretically predicted transition line shown in black here matches nicely with what we found in numerics as we increase the system size. All right, some discussions about the Skirmans. In the phase diagram, we see that there is a big region where the easing type vertex is favored, but the easing Strabi phase and the Moray-Skirmian phase are degenerate. But if we add some external field, it will naturally favor the phase where all the vertices are all the Moray vertices are pointing in one direction instead of pointing in alternate directions like the easing Strapi case. So external field will stabilize this Moray-Skirmian phase. And also we assumed the anti-ferromagnetic layer to be static and only study the ferromagnetic case. This is actually not a very strong constraint. As long as the anti-ferromagnetic layer is in the collinear phase as analyzed in the Homobot layer before, this assumption should work. And actually, for the materials we're interested in, it's always the case that AFM case is in the collinear ordering and we're fine. We can just analyze the ferromagnetic layer. And one can also consider the effect of twisting, which effectively increases the magnitude of the Moray reciprocal lattice factor. And okay, there are also some possible materializations. All right, maybe I can pause in case there are some additional questions regarding this section before I enter some other topic.
So the twisted magnetic order you found all like coplanar order, is it?
Yes, for this the honeycomb case, if we start from the nail order in each layer, the resultant ordered phase will be just the coplanar. For the Skirmion, it's non-coplanar. And for triangular lattice, for example, it won't necessarily be coplanar.
Okay.
All right. Now I will turn to a slightly different topic, which is magic continuum in twisted bilayer square lattice. So this is a work done with Chen Ke Xu from UC Santa Barbara and Chaoming Jian from Cornell. Okay, let me take a minute to motivate why magic continuum is interesting. In a case of identical layers of graphene and twisted by some special angle of 1.1 degrees, magic happens and there are exotic physics which are related to bend flattening at this magic angles. Here is a plot of Dirac velocity versus the twisting angle. As one can see that the Dirac velocity vanishes only at discrete values of twisting angles, these points. So reproducibility of experiments demands very good control of the twisting angle, which is rather challenging. And additionally, the twisting angle can be different in different parts of a bilayer flake. This is magic in this discrete angles. So in general, the twisting angles can be different in different parts of the bilayer flake, since the single layer is very thin and soft, and there can be stresses and strains, which induces spatial variations of the physical properties.
So it would be nice if one can find some system where the band flattening happens not at discrete values of twisting angles, but in a large continuum range of parameters or twisting angles, whereas the interesting correlated behavior may survive robustly. So that's why we want to consider some magic continuum. Okay, and then what is the square lattice with staggered flux and why we're interested in them? A single layer staggered flux square lattice describes a tight binding model with nearest neighbor hoppings subjected to a staggered flux pattern. So here's the Hamiltonian. The square lattice had sublattices A and B labeled blue and black here. And I am summing over one sublattice A. Alpha is the spin index. The parenthesis is the hopping amplitude, which is spatially varying and encodes the staggered flux. The model had several symmetries as below. It apparently breaks the translational symmetry because of the staggered flux, but one can consider a translation, say in the x direction, composed with a particle hole transformation, which is a symmetry of the Hamiltonian. So this composition is a symmetry of the Hamiltonian. And we also have similarly reflection, fourfold rotation, and time reversal symmetry. Don't bother to read these expressions carefully here. I just want to show you they exist. This model can actually be realized experimentally on optical lattices using some laser potentials. The staggered flux state was initially proposed to describe the fractionalized particles in underdoped Kupferis. It has also been widely investigated as a prominent mean field ansatz for algebraic spin liquid that can be viewed as a parent state for many computing orders. It is known, however, that this mean field ansatz for spin liquid are vulnerable to monopoles. In particular, there's a monopole with trivial symmetry, quantum number, and it's relevant. So quantum spin liquid is unlikely the ground state of such systems. In the context of both Kupferis and quantum spin liquid, is the fractionalized particles, the spin-ons, that experience this staggered flux on the square lattice. But in our work, we'll consider a simplified version. We focus on the case where the Fs are just the electrons. However, it still might pave the way to an understanding of twisted ball layers of the spin liquids. Okay, the low energy physics of a single layer is described by four flavors of Dirac fermions. Two comes from spin, two comes from Valley. It has SU4 global symmetry. And now I'm going to smoothly deform this lattice in some arbitrary way with partial U much smaller than one again. And we again use the Eulerian or global coordinates with manifest locality. This transformation in coordinates from R to X leads to the following rewriting of the Dirac fields and the single layer Dirac Hamiltonian. So the first term is still the usual Dirac Hamiltonian. The second term is some linear transformation or rotation of the Pauli matrices. And the third term is a shift of the Dirac points due to the reparameterization. The symmetries of the system also gets modified in the following ways. Compared with the case without deformation, when there's a finite U, the symmetry transformations get some additional phase factors, which physically describe the shift of Dirac cones under these deformations. Now we want to use these symmetries to constrain what types of interlayer interactions are allowed. We will assume first the Hamiltonian is quadratic, and we also assume the interlayer interaction is spin preserving. B means bottom layer, T means top layer, and the M matrix depends on the deformation of two layers. Similar to the Morin magnet case, if we deform the two layers in exactly the same way, nothing should happen to the interlayer interaction. So M should really be dependent only on U top minus U bottom, which I just call U. And furthermore, we know that the deformation of a single layer by two lattice constants must do nothing to the interlayer interaction, because deformation by one lattice constant changes the sign of the flux, while deformation by two lattice constants gives the sign back. And because of this translation symmetry of the deformation field, one can do a Fourier expansion of this matrix M of U. And furthermore, there are additional constraints due to the other lattice symmetries that we have seen before. Okay, and with this constraints, one can write down the most general interlayer term. Here is a minimal description. By minimal, I mean the set of Fourier components involved is a minimal set that is closed under these symmetries. Here, K and K prime are both constant vectors in the momentum space, basically the positions of the Dirac points, K being pi over 2, and K prime is a fourfold rotation of K. M0 and M1 are constant matrices, W1, W2 being arbitrary real parameters, tau is the Pauli matrix in the Dirac spinner space, and mu is the Pauli matrix in the Valley space. One can also go beyond this minimal description with higher momenta, higher Fourier components in the interlayer term, but for convenience, let's focus on the simple one. To get some intuition of the Hamiltonian, we consider first a uniform deformation of one lattice constant between the two layers, or if you like, it's the AB stacked case. It turns out that the one gapless point with 8 degenerate cones, 4 coming from the first layer, the 4 come from the other layer, this one gapless point splits into 4 points, each with 2 degenerate cones. The separation between the cones are proportional to this parameters W1 and W2. Okay, let me skip this slide here. Next, let's turn to the case of the rigid twist, where the U can be written as this, and the theta is the twisting angle. The Hamiltonian of the bilayer system then can be written after some manipulation like this, where the now the twisting angle information is encoded in this parameter W1 and W2. So the larger the W1 and W2, it means the smaller the twisting angle. Computing the band structures, we found several interesting features. First, as the dimensionless parameter increase in magnitude, the whole spectrum gets compressed. For WS, WS is W1 plus W2. For WS goes from 1 to 3, we see the spectrum, the scale of the spectrum shrinks by a factor of 1,000. The lowest energy band with the Dirac cones is still there, but it goes very flat as well. And in addition, the spectrum is everywhere gapless. So it's like a perfect metal. I'll explain these features, each one of them separately. Let me first give you an analytical perspective of the band flattening. It turns out that in the case of the rigid twist, the Hamiltonian can be easily block diagonalized in the layer subspace by this identification. S is plus or minus one. And with this, the Hamiltonian becomes psi dagger H psi, which H being this, which is nothing but just a Dirac fermion in a magnetic field. But the field has now some Moray modulation and is periodic. And the strength of the field depends on the parameters W1 and W2 before. This Hamiltonian is simple enough, and its zero energy states can actually be exactly solved and looks like this. These are the zero energy states, and the deviation from the zero energy, namely the finite but small momentum physics, can be obtained using perturbation in momentum, leading to this new effective Hamiltonian. We observe that this is again a Dirac Hamiltonian, but with a Dirac velocity renormalized by 2 Bessel functions. We can plot this Dirac velocity and see the behavior of this like exponential decay. So compared with the twisted bilayer graphene, where the band flattening happens only at discrete values of twisting angles, here we really have a huge region, a semi-infinite region of magic, namely a magic continuum. Okay, and next, here is an intuitive explanation for the huge number of low energy mini bands when the interlayer coupling is large and the spectrum is compressed. Recall our model is the Dirac fermion in a periodic magnetic field. The field looks like this. And there are thus 2 length scales in the system, the magnetic length proportional to 1 over square root of B, and the period of B field, which is of order 1. When the interlayer coupling is large enough such that LB, the magnetic length, is much smaller than 1, it means the B field varies very slowly, and then one can approximately view it as being uniform and resort to the lambda level analysis. Recall that for Dirac fermions in a uniform magnetic field, the degeneracy of the zero lambda level is proportional to the flux threading through the system. We can do a similar analysis here. When the B field is varying, we no longer have a huge degeneracy for the zero lambda level because this degeneracy is limited by the spatial variation of B. But these previously degenerate bands will remain to be at very low energies nearby. We can separate the Moray brilliant zone into several regions whose centers are the positions where the B field reaches its local extreme. And then we can use the average magnetic field in each subregion to compute the flux threading through this subregion and then sum them up. It turns out that the total flux of the Moray brilliant zone and thus the total number of the low energy Moray mini bands will be proportional to the magnitude of W1 plus the magnitude of W2. here. And this matches perfectly with the numerics. We see a bit of a linear relation here. And next, let me comment on the infinite connectivity of the spectrum. In short, this infinite connectivity is protected by a symmetry called r pi tilde t tilde. R pi is a twofold spatial rotation, and t tilde is a modified time reversal symmetry. And when separate, they are not symmetries of the Hamiltonian, but when composed together, they form a symmetry. And the main message is that the symmetry requires that the number of Dirac points must be even for each band. Furthermore, there is some fourfold rotation symmetry, r power 2, which we introduced before. And this r power 2 squared requires the Dirac points all come in pairs, except at the gamma and m points. So the total number of Dirac cones located at the gamma and m points for each band must be even when combined with the previous item. And if you look at the zero energy state, the blue one, for example, it has a Dirac cone at the gamma point. That's an odd number. To get an even number of Dirac cones in this band, it has to have another Dirac cone at the m point. That's why it connects to the orange band here. And now this orange band has a Dirac cone at m point due to the blue band. But again, one is odd. To make it even, this orange band needs to have another Dirac point at the gamma point, which connects it to the blue band. And one can go on and on and prove that consequently all bands are connected in this way. Okay, now I've explained basically all the features of the spectrum, and let me come to the summary slide of this part. So in this twisted bilayer system of squared lattice with staggered flux, we found some magic continuum, spectrum compression, and infinite conductivity. It would be interesting to study the sensitivity to lattice as well. For example, the Dirac type spectrum with similar SU4 symmetry exists in triangular and Kagome lattice as well. It will be interesting to analyze what will happen there. And secondly, as mentioned above, this staggered flux lattice have been considered as mean field onsets for spin liquids. On a square lattice, it's known that, again, the state is vulnerable to monopoles. However, because of this band flattening, we have large low energy states, which might serve as a large end pool to help suppress the monopoles. But we will leave it for future work to examine this more carefully. For these electrons in the staggered flux, it might be possible to realize them in optical lattices, as suggested by these papers. Okay, that basically summarized my magic continuum part. I can pause for questions
regarding this question.
Yes.
How sensitive, how important is the staggered flux configuration here? Because on the square lattice, there are many flux configurations that can give rise to Dirac fermions, right? Pi flux or even pi over n flux for any integer n. Does this work for those cases?
Yeah, this works for general staggered flux case.
What about uniform flux?
Uniform flux, which corresponds to phi equals zero.
Because I get Dirac fermions there.
So for uniform pi flux, it surely still works. For uniform zero flux, I'm not sure.
Let's say because on the square lattice is the feature that for any pi over n flux with nearest neighbor only hopping, there will be gapless Dirac fermions.
Okay. Pi over n will work. Say that again. So pi over n is a uniform flux?
Yeah.
Oh, then that I don't know. So this is, this is highly dependent on the symmetries of the system.
I see. So pi flux works because it's a special case of the staggered flux.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay, thanks.
Yeah, so maybe I misunderstand your results. So did you apply a magnetic field to the system besides the...
Yes, it's only electron Hamiltonian. So I need to do some external magnetic field to get this staggered flux.
So then why? What's the essential difference between pi flux system and honeycomb? for twisted magnetic graphene, you can also apply a small magnetic field, then you get this magic continuum, right?
Isn't it for the staggered flux, the total flux is zero, right? You don't apply a net magnetic field, right?
That's true. So in a graphene case, you need also have some band flattening. Yeah, I don't have additional comment on that. So this band flattening comes from twisting. Which is a different source of band flattening, and we see this infinite connectivity, which is not there.
So your model can be thought as Dirac fermions on the magnetic field, right?
Yes, effectively, yes.
So then for twisted bilayer, you can also like just apply a magnetic field there.
You mean in twisted bilayer graphene,
you get Dirac fermions and then you apply a very small magnetic field.
Uh-huh.
And do you get magic continuum layer?
I'm not completely sure. I would think it might gap out the system actually. Is it known that it will give you a magic continuum?
No, I don't know. I'm asking.
I'm not sure. I think this can be quite different from different type of lattices.
Okay. Thanks.
So maybe one more question. Sansik, do you?
Yeah, go ahead, Luz.
So this infinite connectivity, does it mean if I want to see correlation physics, I need to go to rather low temperatures? Because it's always connected, then it's not isolated band.
Yeah, so there's no characteristic scale of this system. It's always connected. But I suppose if you add some additional term that breaks the symmetries, for example, it breaks the translation symmetry, it might gap this thing out and we no longer have this infinite connectivity. But yeah, but here, yes, you can go to low energy and strong coupling or small twisting angle to see a large and correlated effect there.
If the temperature is very low.
Mm-hmm. I think that should also work.
Okay, thanks.
So in your analogy to the quantum Hall case, you know, the magnetic field that you have in your analogies, is it real magnetic field or the magnetic field like effect coming from the deformation?
Coming from the deformation.
The deformation. So you're not applying real magnetic field, right?
Say that again. I'm not applying what?
You're not applying real magnetic field.
Weird magnetic field? Sorry.
You're not applying external magnetic field. You are not applying uniform external magnetic field.
No. I need something to generate the staggered flux pattern originally in each layer, but then I don't do anything additional.
Okay. So this magnetic field like thing that arises from the deformation provide some connection, yes. that caused the flat band, is that right?
Yes.
Okay, yeah.
Do I still have time?
Well, it's 1 hour. I don't know. Do you want to? Can you summarize in 5 minutes?
The last section was supposed to be 5 minutes anyway.
Sure.
Okay, so I will briefly mention what we're doing here. So there were two experiments earlier this year which found continuous metal insulator transitions in bilayer transition metal that are cogenized at hot fulling. They have different materials and setups and features. I would just focus on the first one here. Deep inside this metallic phase, the value of resistivity suggests that this order in the system is not playing a dominant role. And the continuous metal insulator transition is mainly driven by the interaction. However, the reported resistivity increases very rapidly with the tuning parameter near the transition. And the bare value of the resistivity is much larger than H over E squared. And it's clearly beyond the multi-ELV regular limit, namely the system near the transition or at the transition is a bad metal. And let me very quickly review the interaction-driven continuous metal insulator transition. The Moray superlattice is a triangular lattice. So the effective model is thus the Hubbert model on triangular lattice and we're also at hot filling. The Lipschitz-Matthes theorem says that the insulating phase cannot both preserve translation and be trivial. When the insulating phase has a semi-classical spin order that breaks translation, the metal insulator transition is two-step. But a more interesting case is when the insulating phase is non-trivial, in particular a spin liquid with spin on Fermi surface. And in this case, the transition can be continuous, where the charge degrees of freedom are gapped at the transition, and the spin degrees of freedom are unaffected. A natural theory that describes this transition is this parton construction, where B is a bosonic parton that carries charge, and F is a fermionic parton that carries spin. There is a U1 gauge field connecting the two. The parton construction is SU2 invariant, and the transition is naturally interpreted as a superfluid to mod insulator transition of boson B. And the resistivity is known to have a jump at the transition from the metal side, which is purely due to the bosons and has a universal value of R H over E squared with R of order one. However, this picture cannot explain bad metal behavior and the big jump in resistivity in experiments. This suggests that the metal insulator transition is not a simple superfluid model insulator transition of B. So we propose another parton construction here. This parton construction gives a spin label to the bosonic parton as well, which explicitly breaks this SU2 invariance. For transition metal dielectric cogenized systems, there's spin valley locking, and the band structure in general does not have full rotation symmetry between the two spin valley flavors, so it's legitimate here. The most obvious difference between the two constructions is that the bosonic parton have different filling factors. So when electrons are at half filling, the bosons are also at half filling instead of integer filling. So again, Lipschitz-Matthes theorem says that the insulator must either be a charge density wave that breaks translation symmetry or a topological order. It turns out that in either case, the bosonic parton further fractionalizes at the metal insulator transition. There's no time for details. I'll show you the results. Suppose each flavor of boson fractionalizes into n parts. Then at the metal insulator transition, each charge carrier has charge E over N. Plugging into the universal expression, we find this additional factor N squared here. And summing over the conductivity for all flavors, we get this R tilde being N squared over NB, with NB the number of boson flavors. In a case of charge density wave, which breaks translation symmetry, we find NB is 2N, such that N tilde is just proportional to N. In the Zn topological order case, NB is 2, R tilde is N squared. So in either of the cases, we have a big enhancement of the resistivity at the transition, which can potentially describe the experimental results. But in general, this is just a new parton construction for the continuous metal insulator transition that might apply to some other system as well. Okay, that's basically it for this section. And here's my summary slide. Looking forward on the Moray magnetism side, it'll be natural to further think about twisted bilayers of paramagnetism, the spin liquids, which is a work in progress. It falls into the category of generating new physics. And extending the twisted bilayer square lattice case is worth examining more carefully whether it really stabilizes direct spin liquid. And this would fall more into the category of realizing known physics. And as some questions suggest that it might be worthwhile to examine other types of models that realize Dirac spectrum as well. And the take home message is there are a lot of things to explore in the playground of flatland. Okay, I think I can take additional questions from here if there's any.
Okay, thank you. Any question?
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Can you go to the first slide of the last part? Yes, yeah. So it's a very simple question, but I'm a bit confused. So this EC, at EC, the resistivity decreases when the temperature increases. So usually we call this insulating behavior instead of metallic behavior.
Yes.
Should I expect it to be at this metal insulator transition, suppose it's interaction driven in a translationally invariant system? Should I expect the transition point to be an insulator?
I'm not completely sure I understand your question. So
So from this data at EC, resistivity decreases.
So this is some insulating behavior. I think if you want, you can understand that the transition happens between these two lines.
Right. It looks like it is approaching a constant at zero temperature, right? That would not be what we'd call, that would not be an insulator. It still has finite resistivity at zero temperature, right? Am I missing something?
Say that again.
It looks like the resistivity is going to a constant as the temperature goes to zero. If at EC.
For which case? For the metal case?
Just at the EC value. It's going to a constant. It's not diverging and it's not going to zero.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, thank you. Yes. Okay. Yeah. For in a pure insulating behavior, the resistivity should go to infinity.
But this dependence is, it has a negative slope. This phenomena is also a usual definition of insulating behavior.
Okay.
I don't know. Okay, thanks.
Maybe a simpler question. So if I try to fit the resistivity jump from the data using your formula, what would be the order of n here?
Yeah, so this is the experiment is roughly the jump in resistivity is of order, I think, 80 times h over e squared. Oh. And what we found for the charge density wave case, what we found is that, we use some dual vertex formalism to describe this transition, and we have some hopping of vertices. And when we include a longer range of hopping of seventh nearest neighbor, we get capital N being six. So this gives me N squared is 36, which is already of the same scale of what I found.
Okay, thanks.
I do remember this. If you have some charge density wave order parameter, that would couple to the Fermi surface at some finite momentum. It will introduce some hotspots. Is this critical theory really studied? I mean, it sounds like a study of the spin density wave case, but the charge density wave case. So the boson undergoes a charge density wave transition at finite momentum. It creates some hot spots on the Fermi surface. The bosonic sector is coupled to the fermionic sector together with the gauge field. Mm. Is this critical theory studied?
I don't think so. I don't think there's a theory for that with the gauge field. So indeed, there can be various types of quartic terms. In the dual vertex formalism that we considered, we examine all the symmetry allowed quartic terms of vertices, and there can also be, as you said, the quartic term involving interaction with fermions. in general, it's not clear what's the our theory for this with all these complicated quadratic terms. But we would think if the, as long as the system flows to some CFT, or even if it eventually flows to some like weakly first order transition, there could still be a finite energy or temperature window where the enhancement of resistivity due to the charge fractionalization will become observable experimentally. I think in this week, several days ago, there was a paper posted by Debenjian and Santol where they commented on the hotspots. They basically considered, if I understand correctly, they claim that at some filling, for example, 1/6, the hotspot can be avoided, but there is no exact or if I understand correctly, there's no calculations of this hotspots.
So here in this theory, the universal jump of the resistivity relies on two things. One is the dynamical decoupling of the bosonic sector from the fermion plus Gibbs field sector. The other is that the fact that the bosonic sector itself is a CFT. So my previous question was really asking whether that dynamical decoupling still happens when the order parameter has some finite momentum. I'm not sure about the question. I'm not sure about the answer.
Uh-huh. Yeah, the short question is, I don't know, it's complicated. but we would still expect some enhancement proportional to n to happen.
Mm-hmm.
For the Zn case with zero momentum, it's easier. The dynamical decoupling always happens.
Okay, thanks.
Because like the coupling of phi squared, phi the bosonic partons and f dagger f, after integrating all the fermions, this term will be irrelevant at the two decoupled 3D XYSR universality class, it's using some known critical exponents.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks.
So in your parton construction, so I was confused, what is the spin quantum number that the boson carries? Yeah, here.
Yeah, so it just carries up and down.
So under SU2, how does...
Yeah, this thing is not invariant on our SU2, no. It breaks SU2. So it's not, that's why it's not usually used in previous studies. And it's we use it here because in transition metal dash-occlusionized, there's this spin valley locking. In general, there can be terms that breaks this SU2 symmetry. So this proton construction is possible.
But is that really necessary? I mean, even if I do the usual one with a single flavor of the boson, that boson can still go to either CDW or topological order, right? Why is this necessary?
It's because of the fillings. For this one, the filling of boson is 1/2. That's why I can use the Lipschitz Mathis theorem. But for this one, it will be an integer filling.
Okay, I see. Yeah, okay. Thanks.
So what state are those half-filled bosons in?
What states? Yeah. In the CDW case, each flavor of the boson further fractionalized, so each fractionalized thing will condense by itself. And in a topological order case, this capital N number of fractionalized charge carriers will condense together at zero momentum.
So this each B fractionalized further into N.
Yes.
And partons?
Yes.
Okay.
Maybe this slide might be helpful. So these are the two critical theories for two cases. psi j's are the fractionalized charge carriers of the each bosonic each flavor of bosonic proton. I've altogether n of them.
And sorry, so that's on triangular lattice. That's the same as in this Sentil and Devanjan's paper.
Yeah, so the paper several days ago. They used a different proton construction.
Okay, but it's also yours is also on triangular lattice.
Yes, we're both triangular lattice. Yes, because we're focusing on the same materials, same right. setup.
Okay, thank you, Yuzi, for interesting talk, and thank you everyone for joining, and we will see you tomorrow again.
Thank you.
Okay, yeah, okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you.